Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We just heard President Trump in a press conference over the last hour or so talking about a little bit about questions linked to impeachment. For more on this now, we have Charlie Jacobs with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, there's a lot that the president talked about, but when it comes to what we know about the efforts to impeach the president, what we saw in that memo of his conversation with the Ukrainian president, what did you hear anything new or interesting in what the president had to say?
No, nothing new. I mean, obviously, he's defending his conversation and its content. I think he's trying to tell the American people that he believes the content is not objectionable in any way and that it doesn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. Of course, that's a really a political question rather than a legal one. And so that's the kind of issue that's just going to have to be discussed and determined both in the court of public opinion as well as the halls of Congress. That's where this is really going to be determined. So I think what he's trying to do is set a narrative about what he did that tries to preempt anything that the Democrats might want to do in the House of Representatives.
Now, as described in this memorandum, the summary of the president's conversation with the president of the Ukraine, they talk about the Bidens. The president appears to invite cooperation between the Ukrainian government, the United States Attorney General, the president's personal attorney, Rudolph Giuliani. What do you make of that?
Well, it does seem like an unusual scenario, primarily because if there's suspicion of a crime or corruption, it would be the purview of the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Justice Department to look into that. And, of course, they may rely upon information gathering from other areas, but it's particularly the purpose of those kinds of arms of law enforcement in the United States to do the investigations. And then to include what is tantamount to a private citizen, even though Rudy Giuliani obviously works closely with the President of the United States as his personal attorney. It's sort of an odd request to have a private citizen like that dealing with these kinds of accusations of corruption, as well as what is, in essence, foreign policy for the United States, something that the State Department frowns upon, private citizens engaging in serving as a mouthpiece for the United States or engaging in these kinds of talks with foreign entities.
That Giuliani has acclaimed, and I don't think this has been confirmed by the State Department, but he has claimed that the State Department asked him to undertake interactions in Ukraine.
In a rather vague statement from the State Department last night, they seemed to indicate that they hadn't solicited that kind of help. But again, the statement was so vague, it didn't really have very much substantive content to lead anyone to know whether or not there was some engagement that they asked for with Giuliani in this regard. So again, there's sort of mystery upon obfuscation, upon wonderment about exactly what is going on, because most of the statements, you know, reveal some, but not everything that the public and I think Congress would like to know about these deals.
We're waiting to see if whistleblower information from the person who apparently raised this issue of this call, though also reportedly other issues. We're waiting to see what Congress will get when it relates to that. And of course, what the public would see. We might see nothing. We might see lots. I don't know. How important is that part of the story?
I think it's important because from what we understand, it's a contemporaneous hearing of what was going on in this conversation. And remember, what was released today was not a verbatim transcript of the conversation. And so what we're going to have is an intelligence professional who is going to be interpreting what the president said and what the conversation was about and how that relates to our ability to conduct foreign affairs with a country like the Ukraine. And so I think that kind of perspective is going to be interesting, and to see what was contained in that whistleblower report and what the concerns were is going to be illuminating to exactly what drove this process to unearth what's going on with the president and his relations with the Ukrainian president.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs about today's press conference from President Trump, the ongoing now impeachment inquiry proceedings just announced yesterday by leaders of the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. We'll get back to Charlie Jacobs in just a few minutes. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We are talking about impeachment efforts against President Trump, his press conference today, the memorandum about his conversation with the president of the Ukraine. You can join in if you have thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charlie Jacobs stays with us from St. Norbert College. Quick reminder, you can pledge in support of our conversations here, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Charlie, taking a step back from the day's news, give us the long view. What happens next now that this impeachment inquiry is started?
Well, the interesting thing is I'm not sure anybody really knows, because the rules are vague. The Constitution is vague about how the process unfolds, and we've only really done this two other times. And so there's a lot of freedom for the Democrats in the House to see how this unfolds. Right now, they're doing investigations of the president in various aspects of it in up to about six different committees. So in essence, they're already doing an impeachment inquiry, and they don't have to vote on anything. That's been done in the past, but they have the freedom not to sort of create a formal process. If they don't want to, they could actually just move to a vote on some articles of impeachment that they write up very quickly. So it sort of remains to be seen exactly how Pelosi wants to handle this. And I think part of it is she's trying to see how many votes she has. So how quickly or how slowly she goes, I think, depends on the evidence that they start to collect and whether or not it's convincing enough to her caucus, as well as maybe some Republicans, that they move forward with the vote in the House to actually affirm articles of impeachment. Because remember, that's only one step in this process. And we sometimes conflate the idea of impeachment with the removal of the president, but it's actually a two-step process.
Right. We've had two presidents, I think it is, impeached, meaning the House voted to impeach them, but then acquitted in a trial by the Senate, presided over, I think, by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
That's correct. I mean, I like to sort of describe the impeachment or removal process in terms of the television show Law and Order, which is sort of very formulaic. The first half hour is always the investigation, and it ends with an indictment, and then we turn over the whole case to the court system. Well, that's kind of what happens here. The House conducts an investigation, and then if they believe that the evidence they've collected rises to the level of impeachment, they in essence indict the president, and it shoots over to the Senate, where they conduct a full-blown trial, although it doesn't really match what you're going to see in real life. But the jurors are, in essence, the 100 senators, and both the president and then the House of Representatives would put on the case to determine whether or not it's convincing enough to those sitting there in the Senate to convict him, which would result in his removal. And that, of course, takes two-thirds of the sitting senators.
Before we move on to what that would take in the Senate, let's stay in the House for a minute. You mentioned drafting articles of impeachment. I've seen differences among Democrats, apparently, versus I'll call it a skinny impeachment, just looking at this Ukraine issue versus, like, hold on, can we look at the Mueller probe and say the president obstructed justice when he fired James Comey, when he directed others to fire Robert Mueller? Emoluments, is the president in violation of the Constitution when his business takes money from foreign governments? So just the one thing or the laundry list, what are the pros and cons there, Charlie?
Well, I think that if you're more laser focused and you find what many might agree is the most egregious charge, right, the article that might get the most support, you know, if you're a prosecutor, you want to be able to convince the jury easily rather than have a whole bunch of evidence that's really circumstantial and you don't have much proof. So I think that Pelosi would probably prefer to take the strongest case and make that the singular article of impeachment. It's kind of what happened with Clinton. I mean, he had four articles that he was facing, but only two were accepted by the House. So I think that may be the approach, because they have to look at their jury. And, you know, as one political scientist once wrote about the impeachment, while it's really loose in the sense that you don't have to have a criminal act to impeach, because you only need 34 senators to upend the conviction, you really have to have something strong, because they're probably going to have the narrowest view of what constitutes something that would remove the president from office.
And in this case, you have a Republican president with a Republican majority Senate. That makes it maybe more of a tall order.
It does, except that in an election year where some red state Republicans who are running for re-election may be somewhat worried about being able to carry independence, or if they feel just somewhat jittery about the ability of the president to have coattails as the president is getting impeached and potentially removed, you may see some skittishness among some of these Republicans. It's really hard to say because we don't know the full information that we might see from some of the other documents that come. At the moment, I think that everybody's kind of staying a little bit mum until they have fuller information.
Now, this is getting speculative here about the timing, but if I'm a Republican senator, I'm maybe not going to go against President Trump before somebody can run a primary campaign against me. If this takes long enough and it's too late for somebody to primary me, does that free up my range of motion a little bit?
Yeah, it probably does. I mean, the deeper you get into the election cycle and, you know, the longer this sticks around, it becomes more of an albatross for your electoral prospects. So that is certainly the case. And but here's the thing is that since the Senate is going to run how this this trial is conducted and Mitch McConnell is the leader, he may have some political calculations about exactly how this will unfold. I mean, you could do it really early and then that way it seems as though the president is exonerated, or you could wait very deep into the process where the public is so distracted that they may sort of ignore what are the weaknesses of the president, and then he gets acquitted late, and that's the message into the last couple of weeks of the election. So there's a strategy that McConnell and the Republicans can take about how they conduct this that may very much help the president in his reelection.
Let's bring in a caller. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The question I have is that if Joe Biden truly was, say, compromised by his son's activities in the Ukraine, and he was going to be running a presidential campaign, doesn't it make sense that the president of the United States protect the United States from a compromised candidate? Isn't this really just the mainstream media again ignoring activities of the Democrats, and they really are out to get Donald Trump?
Charlie, thanks for the call. What do we know about the Biden side of this? That's the Charlie's on the angle that President Trump is promoting here for sure.
Right. So what we know is that Biden's son, Hunter, took a position with a gas company in Ukraine and was being paid $50,000 a month. He resigned from that position in early 2019. The White House apparently vetted this, and although that there were some suspicions that this could be, you know, deemed as inappropriate because he was a private citizen and unconnected to the activities of the White House directly, they thought it was okay. I mean, Biden got involved in this because his issue was they were trying to promote democracy in the Ukraine. And the argument was this prosecutor, who actually wasn't looking into the company for which Hunter Biden looked with any aggressiveness, he was so weak in ferreting out the corruption that Vice President Biden wanted him tossed because he wanted somebody who was more aggressive about looking into this corruption. And there was a lot of support from some European nations, apparently, for the same thing. So, I mean, I don't think that we have necessarily the full story, but what we do know about the process so far is that, yes, it looks a little untoward that the vice president's son is getting a big pile of money every month. But at the same time, the White House at the time and a lot of the reporting on the issues suggests that, if anything, Biden was pursuing more aggressive activity regarding ferreting out that corruption in Ukraine than trying to diminish it and protect his son.
As we wrap up, Charlie, what are you watching for next?
I'm watching for what Pelosi does and how she manages this, because, of course, she's got the politics with her caucus. She has to manage the collection of data and information from the White House and trying to fend off any sort of legal challenges through executive privilege of getting necessary information. So this is going to be a sticky kind of situation. But Pelosi is a very seasoned politician, and I suspect that she and her staff have talked through this. So we just have to see how this unfolds in the coming weeks.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Pleasure.
That's Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere, with us with the latest on impeachment and the president's press conference earlier today. If you have questions on the workings of impeachment, you can check out a Central Times segment from June that explains the process. Go to WPR.org and search Requirements for Impeachment. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran have escalated sharply this year. First, the U.S. said Iran was behind attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf over the summer. Iran has denied involvement. And more recently, the U.S., along with France, Germany, and the U.K., have blamed Iran for an attack on two oil facilities in Saudi Arabia a couple weekends ago. The Saudis, who also blame Iran, said the drone and missile strikes took out about half of the country's oil production. In response, Iran says it had nothing to do with the attacks and warned the U.S. and its allies against a military response. In a speech to the United Nations General Assembly yesterday, President Trump pledged to keep squeezing Iran economically until they give up their quest for nuclear weapons.
All nations have a duty to act. No responsible government should subsidize Iran's bloodlust. As long as Iran's menacing behavior continues, sanctions will not be lifted. They will be tightened.
In an interview scheduled to be aired this weekend on Fox News, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said America supports terrorism in the Middle East and called on the U.S. to lift sanctions. Ali Aboudalebi is a professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire. His areas of expertise include Iran, Middle East politics, U.S. Middle East policy, and Islam. He just returned from a two-month stay in Iran. Ali, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the big picture, I want you to take us to Iran. You were there at this very tense time between the two countries. What were you hearing from people there in the country?
Well, actually, from outside, things portrayed to be desperate. But while you're there, Iranians, for the most part, are living their lives, and life is as normal as it can be, with the exception that there is a lot of pressure on wages and prices. And do most people, they try to have a couple of jobs, or if they cannot afford housing, they stay with their parents and families and relatives. They improvise, so to speak, to cut down on the cost of living. And when it comes to their daily lives and expenditures, they have to choose between what they can afford and what they want. So they have become choosier. In terms of what they pick. So most people, I guess by implication, they don't eat as much meat as they used to, or they choose for lower quality fruits or products in the market. But nevertheless, market is full of products. Everything you want is there. There is no shortage whatsoever. The problem is that the prices are really high, especially if you are an employee, work for the government, or if you are a wage earner. Your fundamental monthly income doesn't meet your monthly expenditures, particularly when it comes to housing. The housing prices, whether you're renting or you want to buy, they're so very much expensive that you need at least two income earner households in order to be able to make the rent and have a decent life.
And is this in part or in large part because of the U.S.-led sanctions and other economic pressure on Iran?
Well, the Iranian government insists this is the main cause. And indeed, this is a big part of it. There's no doubt that the Iranian economy can do better with better management, better banking system, and less corruption. There's no doubt. But nevertheless, sanctions have had a drastic impact because partially some of the corruption that we see in the economy, society, is because of sanctions. That the government and the companies and different organizations, they try to bypass the sanctions. And in the midst of this, there are people who use their position in government or position of power to enrich themselves. A simple example is the currency market. Since Iran has two kind of exchange rate adopted by the government, one for the importers of essential commodities and one in the market, and the difference between the two is tremendous, 300% price differences. Those who can afford, they acquire dollar and they sell it in the open market and become millionaires and billionaires over a matter of days and weeks. So there is corruption, there is manipulation, and there's opportunity for for smuggling, kind of bypassing the sanction, increasing the level of corruption. So sanctions has some major impact, I would argue.
Ali, I won't ask you to sum up the entirety of Iranian public opinion here, but what did you hear from people? Did they say, oh, our government and the corruption and the troubles they're leading us into internationally, they're to blame for these economic inconveniences, or the Americans and their sanctions are to blame?
For the most part, there's a lot of complaint about the performance of government, and corruption really bothers Iranian. I mean, as soon as our corruption news in the papers, et cetera, everybody complained about it. At the same time, Iranians, they have come to appreciate what they have achieved in the last 40 years. Simply national pride, kind of being independent, and they look at the area of nuclear achievements and defense achievements, nanotechnology, agriculture, some industry. There's a sense of national pride among people, especially young people, who by far are a lot more educated now than before revolution. So despite all the differences and despite many fingers pointed at government or America or other forces, they don't want drastic changes through intervention or revolution, or so to speak. They want changes from within. And government, of course, bombard them with the point that much of your problem is because of sanctions. So they do indeed blame both ends. And the ones who can afford it, they try to emigrate, especially among the young people. But the fact is that Iran has 82, 83 million people, and people cannot all leave. And they can do a lot better should the sanctions be lifted. I've argued in my writing and my discussion that if the sanctions are lifted, Iran has enough resources and manpower to go through a major economic change that would impact Iran and the region within the next 10, 20 years. But that all has to do with sanctions and politics.
Ali Aboudalebi is with us, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, just back from a stay in Iran. We're looking at what's going on in Iran and between the Iran and the U.S. And let's zoom out now, Ali, to look at the latest tensions. This drone strike on Saudi Arabian oil facilities. A lot of countries, Europe and the United States included, European countries and the United States included, blaming Iran for these attacks. What do we know about Iranian complicity in this attack?
What we hear in the media. I mean, obviously, the Iranian made weaponry which hit the installations. There is no doubt about that. But nevertheless, in terms of whether they came from Iran or from the Houthis, people can debate this. On one hand, of course, if you argue they came from Iran, and then the question is raised, how come all this sophisticated weaponry and American bases in the region could not detect these 10 and drones and the missiles, which is not a pleasant question. If you argue that they came from the south, from Houthi Yemen, similar question can apply. I do understand that United States and, of course, Europeans now blame Iran because of the nature of the attack. And, you know, I'm not going to argue that it did not initiate from Iran or it did. I think the question is the wrong question. The better question is, how can we de-escalate and go back to the normal situation? Because obviously, as everybody knows, a war is to no one's benefit, whether Iran or United States or even Saudi Arabia or Gulf states. So the real question is how to de-escalate, and the answers are not that complex. We need to deal with the question of Yemen and the war in Yemen, and of course with the United States sanctions. Without kind of defacing ourselves, United States and Iran can find or should find ways to go back to the agreement, so to speak. At least that is Iranian demand. Should the United States come back to the nuclear agreement, then many good things happen. And Iranians have signaled that they're actually ready to amend some of the clauses in the agreement to the satisfaction of the United States should the U.S. come on board. But, of course, that would be a major benefit to Iran. So the question is, how can we de-escalate and how can we address the war in Yemen, which basically are turning to quagmire for Saudi Arabia and tremendous death and misery for Yemen? And I think these are legitimate points to be to raise if you're talking about this attack on Saudi Arabia, because the attack did not come in a vacuum. It came from within a context, and the context is Yemen war and Iranian the sanction on Iran.
Is it that simple to untangle the war in Yemen? As you say, the Saudi Arabian government heavily involved there, this war going on for a long time, Iran supporting the other side, bigger international players having their own roles, including the United States. How do you, we've talked about this a little before, how do you untangle that at this point?
I think the United States have a very big sway, so to speak, over Saudi Arabia. We could be persuasive that it's better for Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf states, mainly, you know, United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, to come up with new understanding. Recall that even the Gulf Arab states, they are not getting along among themselves. You know, Saudis and UAE and Bahrain, they went against one of their fellow partners, Qatar, and Qatar, that pushed Qatar more toward Iran. The war is not serving Saudi interests, except they're wasting the resources buying weapons. And if when you look at Yemen, Yemen actually had civil war in the 1960s, which led to Yemen again split as becoming two countries. And then again, Saudi Arabia did intervene, as well as Egypt. And that was within the Cold War conflict. In the 1990s, Yemen became a country, but never was able to pick up his own weight and become a kind of sovereign state living under the shadow of Saudi Arabia. And because of conflict and ethnic issues, all that in Yemen, the war started. But Saudi intervention, I understand why Saudi did this, but have not turned successful. I think through negotiation, we can come up with this resolution agreeable to both Saudi Arabia and Iran and the United States. Of course, Saudis are concerned should there be peace in Yemen, they may ally themselves with Iran. But there are mechanisms to make sure that it's not going necessarily be to the detriment of Saudi Arabia.
Now, France and Britain's leaders have urged President Rouhani of Iran to meet with President Trump. Iran says no one-on-one talks until the U.S. returns to the nuclear deal. The U.S. had left the deal in effect a while back. So do you see worthwhile negotiations happening anytime soon?
Not unfortunately. I mean, if this is the case, that is, Prime Minister Zarif has mentioned that, you know, can we trust American signature and promises and come back to negotiation if they broke the first agreement to begin with. And, you know, we are not dealing with the American government, or we are dealing with the American state or country, as well as the United Nations Security Council. I think these are legitimate points raised by Prime Minister, by Foreign Minister Zarif. The United States, of course, cannot simply go back to the agreement without losing face. But I think behind the scene negotiations can open the way. We have to water it down, the idea that the conflict is not going to serve anybody, that the United States may go back to a nuclear agreement should there be some changes to the agreement. And Iranians already signaled that they're willing to include new clauses or new points in the clauses, kind of addressing U.S. concern. I think that is an opening that Trump administration has to say, okay, we didn't blink, they blink, they wanted to renegotiate and enter into negotiation and lift up the sanctions. And once that happened, then we can also pressure Iran on their missile program if we want. But you cannot just pressure on missile and nuclear program and expect cooperation while Iran is really suffering under sanctions.
Ali, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Ali Abutalibi, professor of political science at UW-Eau Claire, with us to talk about the latest news between Iran and the U.S. and to tell us what he saw in his recent stay, two-month stay in Iran. Central Time is produced by J. Carlisle Larson, Dean Knetter, Bill Martins, Rachel Vasquez, and Tim Peterson. Sarah Hopeful is our technical director, and Judith Sears-Poisson is our executive director. This is Central Time. We'll be right back.